This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Thank you and goodbye. That's the headline of Britain's biggest selling newspaper today, the News of the World. After 168 years and amid an escalating scandal of phone hacking, the paper has published its last issue. David Falkenflik is in London following the story. David, thanks for being with us this morning.
You bet.
So, how do the longtime readers feel with this last issue coming out?
Well, for people who are devotees of the paper, they're wistful about it. It's been an expected friend that they can turn to every Sunday. I talked to a number of people who said, look, it was a good combination of news and gossip, and you could rely on it. And there are other people who said that they just dipped into it as they would a popular magazine. One woman I talked to, Lorna Conlon, was from Ireland.
It's a bit of a guilty pleasure, really. It's bit of nothingness, like the paper, there's not really anything like of too much substance in it. You don't really believe half what you read, but it's like reading a magazine, really.
That's Lorna Conlon from Ireland. You know, these people are saying they can get this elsewhere, but that they'll miss it in the News of the World.
What about the staff of this newspaper?
Well, not wistful, but quite angry. Most of the people on staff at the News of the World had nothing to do with this scandal, as most of them weren't there in the time that it occurred. It sort of ended at 2006, the first revelations of hacking into the mobile phones of the royals. There was a very confrontational meeting that the staff held on Friday with Rebecca Brooks, who's the chief executive of the British newspaper division of News Corp. People at the newspaper are wondering why they lose their jobs when she gets to keep hers. After all, she had been editor of News of the World herself at a time when murder victims' voicemails had been hacked by investigators for the paper, and she's been overseeing the company at a time where it turns out that this scandal has metastasized. So if you read today's newspaper, it was really more of a celebratory valedictory. There was an editorial where they say, we're truly sorry, we lost our way. But all in all, they seem to assign this to a few bad apples, which is now something really under attack. The people there now say, hey, not our fault, but we're taking the blame.
So is there any sense that this is a sort of a temporary arrangement, at least for the big shooters on the staff of this paper, that they'll close the doors and then they'll paste a new name on the building and open them again?
Well, there certainly is widespread belief that the sister tabloid of Weekday called The Sun will become The Sun on Sunday and hire, you know, some of the folks from the News of the World to put out a Sunday tabloid. That's a wide, deep-spread belief. Folks at News Corp's British division tell us nothing is set yet. They haven't decided.
What about the political fallout?
Well, the political fallout is coming fast and furious. It's still there. Interestingly, this morning, the Sunday Times, which is itself a Rupert Murdoch-owned, News Corp-owned newspaper, reports that it turns out there was an internal report from News International itself done in 2007, that's 4 years ago, that did find hacking to be widespread in the newspaper, but that was not released to authorities and that was not told to James Murdoch, who heads the British operations and is obviously Rupert Murdoch's son as well. Why does this matter? Well, first off, it might implicate the publisher of the Wall Street Journal, Les Hinton, who at that time was the chief executive of News International here. And secondly, it's caused the head of the Labour Party, Ed Miliband, to say, we should stop Rupert Murdoch and News Corp from gaining control of the nation's largest broadcaster, BSkyB. That's very much up in the air, very big issue. Rupert Murdoch himself has flown to the country to try to start to take this issue on himself.
NPR's David Falkenflik, he's reporting from London on the News of the World. David, thank you.
My pleasure.
Have you wondered why most supermarket tomatoes taste pretty bland? Well, our book today, Tomatoland, answers that question. And for author Barry Estabrook, the journey to finding that answer began one day when he was driving down a road in rural Florida. And right in front of him, he saw a truck. It was piled high with what appeared to be green Granny Smith apples.
When I pulled out to pass, three of them sailed off the truck, narrowly missing my windshield. At the first stoplight, I got a closer look. The shoulder of the road was littered with green tomatoes, so plasticine and so identical they could have been stamped out by a machine. Most looked smooth and unblemished. A few had cracks in their skins. Not one was smashed. A 10-foot drop, followed by a 60-mile-per-hour impact with pavement, is no big deal to a modern agribusiness tomato.
Estabrook followed the green tomato trail all the way through Florida's giant farms and down into South America to trace the fruit's wild ancestors. And what he found along the way might make you think twice before you bite into your next BLT. Barry Estabrook's book is called Tomatoland, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. And he joins me now from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Barry Estabrook, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Take me through the life of a modern supermarket tomato.
Well, depending on the time of year, at certain times of the winter, 90% of the fresh tomatoes that we find in the supermarkets are grown in Florida.
It's somewhat of an irony because you say in the book, and right off the bat, you say Florida is probably the least suitable place to grow tomatoes. So why is that?
Well, there's two main problems. One is Florida is notoriously humid, and the humidity is a perfect environment for all of the funguses, rusts, and insect pests that prey on Florida tomatoes. Hmm. So it's just a horrible climate. And the other thing is tomatoes in Florida, most of them, are in fact grown in sand. It's no different than the stuff on Daytona Beach, and it lacks nutrition in the same exact way.
How did Florida become the center, or the main sort of area where American tomatoes are grown then? I mean, if the soil is bad, if the climate's terrible, which means you have to use a lot of pesticides, why did it happen in Florida?
It happened for the simple reason of commerce. It nothing to do with biology or horticulture. It was that Florida, during the winter months, happens to be within a day or two's tractor-trailer ride from three-quarters of the population of the country.
Now, you argue in the book, and I will say I agree with you, that most supermarket tomatoes in America taste awful. They have no taste at all.
The reason is, as a farmer said, an honest farmer, he said, I don't get paid a cent for flavor. I get paid by the pound, pure and simple. So for the last 50 years, all of our best minds in commercial tomato plant breeding have been breeding varieties for one thing: yield. And when they're picked from the field, they are absolutely green. And they're taken to a warehouse, and they're exposed to ethylene gas. And what that does is it makes the tomato turn red. It won't get any more flavor than it had when it went in there, but it will turn obligingly red.
I'm speaking with Barry Estabrook. His new book is called Tomato Land: How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. Barry, a big part of this book is not just about, obviously, the taste of tomatoes, but about the process of getting them to market. And you describe this world, and I'm using your words, you describe a world where slave labor is employed.
Let me run down a few little items here. People being bought and sold like animals. People being shackled in chains. People being beaten for either not working hard enough, fast enough, or being too weak or sick to work. People actually being shot and killed for trying to escape. That sounds like 1850s slavery to me. And that, in fact, is going on or has gone on. There were, in the last 15 years, there have been 7 successful prosecutions, slavery prosecutions in the state of Florida. Even, you know, the ones that are not being held as slaves probably work at the very, very bottom of the American workforce. They receive no union benefits. They receive no benefits of any sort. They get no vacation pay. They get no medical insurance. They get no overtime, even if they work more than 40 hours a week or more than 8 hours a day. They're paid basically per pound that they pick. If it rains, they don't make a cent that day.
You describe the pesticides that have to be used, and presumably these workers are exposed to a lot of those pesticides.
Well, in fact, the official Florida government handbook for commercial tomato growers lists 110 different herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides that a farmer can apply to his tomatoes over the course of a season. And sadly, I must have talked to 36 workers, and I asked all of them the same question, you know, have you ever been sprayed? They said, man, all the time, 2-3 times a week.
A few years ago, some of these farm workers in Florida started to organize, actually, and there was a campaign backed by some labor unions and student groups, and their conditions apparently improved. What happened?
In the last 7 or 8 months, there's just been a sea change in labor relations in the Florida tomato industry. What had happened was this small group of grassroots people called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers had been lobbying since the early 90s to get a raise and to have some basic primitive workers' rights put in place. What they started concentrating on was the end customers of these farmers. They started with the Taco Bell restaurant chain and after 4 years, Taco Bell said, okay, we've had enough. I mean, 4 years of boycotts, demonstrations. They signed a board. And then gradually, all the other fast food chains in the country, one by one, often kicking and screaming, signed on to this agreement. The sad thing is that not a single supermarket chain in the country, with the exception of Whole Foods, has agreed.
So if somebody really wanted to eat tomatoes in the winter, could they do? I mean, somebody listening to this now saying, all right, you know, I want to do this right. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to eat a bad tomato. I don't want to support this system of industrialized tomatoes. I just want to have, but I do want to have a fresh tomato in December, January. What would you say?
I would very reluctantly say, get a hydroponic tomato and hope that there's some taste in it.
But really you're saying that they shouldn't eat tomatoes after September?
I think tomatoes in grocery stores are like food porn in the purest sense of the word. They look nice. They tantalize you. They make you think, but they don't deliver. You're not getting the same thing by any measure that you get in the summer, either from your own garden or from a farmer's market or even in a supermarket that does carry local tomatoes.
That's Barry Esterbrook. His new book is called Tomato Land: How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. Barry, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
So it is really summer now. It's very hot in most of the country. We're thinking about vacation trips or maybe stay-at-home vacations, and we're thinking about books. Not the sort of eat your spinach books that we need to read in the cold, dark months, but summer sorts of books. So this month, we'll visit bookstores in four places people like to visit, places all across the country, to find out what people are reading when they can read whatever they want. Today we speak with Françoise Pio. She's the owner of Garcia Street Books, and she joins us from her store in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
Now, you don't you don't sound like you're from Santa Fe.
No, I'm not from Santa Fe. I was born in Belgium.
And how is business this summer?
Business has been slowed down a little bit because of the forest fires, but it's picking up greatly.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yes.
Now, is there one particular book that you're kind of having trouble keeping in stock that is just running out of the store?
Yes, Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese.
Mm-hmm.
The Help by Catherine Stockett. And for the regional books, Empire of the Summer Moon by S.C. Gwynne.
What is that one? That's one I haven't heard of.
It's one on the Comanche Empire in the 1700s and 1800s.
Do you recommend that to your customers, or are people actually coming in looking for it?
They come and look for it, to the point that I have bought it myself.
And did it surprise you? Did you not expect that to be a big summer book?
No, I was expecting more paperback fiction, mm-hmm. rather than nonfiction.
So if you were going to name a Southwestern book that's a hot book for you this summer, what would it be?
To Hell on a Fast Horse, The Untold Story of Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett by Mark Lee Gardner. And, of course, Randy Lopez Goes Home by Rodolfo Anaya, who's a local author.
Alan Chews reviewed that book on our air, Randy Lopez Goes Home, about a man who makes his fortune in the Anglo world and then returns to his home village in New Mexico. Alan Chews called it a kind of a pilgrim's progress.
It's flying off the shelves, even though it's hardback.
Hmm. What's the cookbook that's hot this summer? I'm from New Mexico, so I'm partial to the food.
Any cookbook that's about chili peppers and the New Mexico style of cooking.
Uh-huh.
We have some great restaurants here that have their own cookbooks, and people go eat there, and then they come here to buy the book.
Françoise Pao, she spoke with us from Garcia Street Books in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Linda.
Next week, we'll check in with another bookstore. The number of migrants from Central America and Mexico who try to cross illegally into the U.S. has dropped dramatically over the last few years. One reason is the economic downturn in the United States. Another is increased security on the southern border. But migration also is being suppressed because the trip has become incredibly dangerous. Mexican drug cartels are increasingly involved in the smuggling, kidnapping, and extortion of migrants. NPR's Jason Beaubien recently traveled along much of the migrant trail in Mexico. He sent us this reporter's notebook about the journey.
When you start thinking about crossing Mexico without using a plane or a bus or a car, Mexico's vastness becomes striking. The shortest route from the Guatemalan border to Brownsville, Texas, is just over 1,000 miles. If you're headed to California and plan to cross at Tijuana, it's more than 2,000 miles. And now the trek is more perilous than ever. I wouldn't recommend this trip to anyone, one Honduran told me as he waited for a bus in southern Mexico. You don't know who will rob you, who is good, who is bad. He was kidnapped last year in the midst of this same journey, beaten and forced to pay $3,000 for his freedom. But unfortunately, in our country, he adds, we aren't left any other option except to emigrate. Last year alone, according to Mexico's Human Rights Commission, 20,000 migrants were kidnapped and hundreds more were killed or disappeared. Talking to dozens of migrants on the route, three strong themes emerged: fear, God, and family. The fear of getting kidnapped hangs over the migrants the entire trip. They're also terrified of Mexican authorities who may demand bribes or hand them over to kidnappers or deport them home. God keeps coming up as the only force that's protecting them. In Mexico, most migrants are in the country illegally. They have nowhere and no one they can turn to for help, they say, except for God. In between their fear and their faith, many people say the trip is about family. Migrants alone on the road told me that they're doing this for their kids, for a better future. Many left their children back home in El Salvador, Honduras, or rural southern Mexico. I think of my sons almost constantly, one man told me. The migrants know they're putting their lives at risk to try to get to the United States, and they're willing to take that gamble. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News. Comic books often get a bad rap. Some see them as juvenile and primitive, but a group of Michigan cartoonists see them as a sophisticated art form, and they're promoting comics as a valuable educational tool for kids, especially those who are struggling. Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris reports.
At the Northville District Library, 30 miles west of Detroit, cartoonist Jersey Drost is whizzing around a room full of 6th and 7th graders. He asked them what they would do if they were in a grocery store, and they wanted to get their parents' attention.
You get big, right? Look over here, Frosted Cheerios are 50% off, and if I don't get them, I'm just going to die, right? Yeah, you get big because you want to be noticed.
Drost says that's why panels are different sizes in comics.
Space equals emphasis. It means big, it means important, it means notice me.
The class brainstorms a few characters: Betty Boop, Tom from Tom and Jerry, and they devise a simple plot. Drost then assigns a specific action for each panel.
Panel 4, surprise moment of the story, surprise character gets thrown in, Justin Bieber shows up.
In panel 5, Justin Bieber and Tom fight for the love of Betty Boop.
Stay with me.
But they make up in panel 6, and everybody shares a pizza.
Okay, so here's your challenge. My brilliant artists, choose these 6 moments. You're going to decide for yourself which moment takes the longest to happen. Is that going to be a big panel or a small panel?
Drost says this kind of thinking about space and the way the story is laid out on the page is sophisticated.
You have to learn about how to get your audience to make inferences about the characters, what you show, what you don't show. It's not just what they say. It's not just what's in the written word. How a character's body language works, a little turn of the lip, a certain kind of smile that communicates volumes of information.
Drost is teaching these skills to kids in Michigan towns where people are struggling. Comic writer Dan Mishkin is helping Drost with a tour. He says creating comics can help kids having a rough time because it gives them a sense of control and power over their own stories, as opposed to doing something like, say, bullying other kids.
Telling your story in this narrative form that you actually are capable of working in is kind of easier to do and feel like you've accomplished something.
And all you need is some paper and a 25-cent pencil. Seventh grader Claire Ramsden cracks open a thick sketchbook filled with page after page of her artwork. She says she creates a new character about every 2 days. Ramsden's latest invention has magical powers and is named Scream.
She's mainly quiet. She never shows her eyes or her hands. She's just kind of back there in the background.
Ramsden says she's proud of the stuff she draws. And Jersey Drost says that's what his workshop is all about, helping kids realize they can tell their stories, quite elegantly, with pictures. For NPR News, I'm Kyle Norris.
This is NPR News.
Believe it or not, there's one topic that virtually every lawmaker here in Washington agrees about, and that is America's tax code is a mess.
I've heard it said that it's 10 times the size of the Bible without the good news.
That's Republican Congressman Charles Bustani from Louisiana. We'll hear more from him in a moment. He's on the House Ways and Means Committee, and this coming week, that committee will hold a historic joint hearing with its Senate counterpart about changing the way we all pay taxes. And reforming the code is something President Obama is even discussing with House Republicans. The question is, how do you untangle the web that already exists? That's our cover story today. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Now, last year, the U.S. government spent $3.5 trillion, but because of high unemployment and a weak economy, it only collected just over $2 trillion in taxes. And unless something changes pretty soon, the government faces chronic shortfalls for the foreseeable future, which is why so many members of Congress want to change the tax code, including Republican Dave Camp. He's the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee.
We need to make sure we have a constant effective rate. So what we're looking at is doing away with some of these exceptions, loopholes, business provisions, whatever you want to call them, that make the effective rate different for different companies.
Now, you've probably heard that America has the highest corporate tax rate in the industrialized world. At 35%, that is actually true. But what that number doesn't reveal is that very few corporations in America pay anything near that rate because of all of the hundreds and thousands of loopholes and incentives and credits in the tax code. The difficulty in fixing the problem will be coming to a compromise over which incentives to ditch and which ones to keep. Here's Virginia Senator Mark Warner. He's a Democrat and a leading voice on tax reform.
The tax code right now is 70,000 pages long. It literally costs hundreds of billions of dollars in terms of transaction costs for individuals and companies to fill out their taxes. Many of the exemptions, tax policies we've made over the last 25 years, individually they might make some sense, but in aggregate they make our code much too complex. So our goal is to actually lower tax rates, but at the same time remove a lot of these tax exemptions, recognize them for what they are, which is government spending by a different name.
Now, the top tax rate right now is 35%. Under your proposal for an individual or for a couple or joint filers, what would the top rate be?
Well, we're still talking about that. It would go down. The question is whether it's at 30, 32, 29, I mean, I think those are issues we've still got to work through, but it would go down. But at the same time, I would then be giving up some of the tax exemptions that are currently in the code.
When you say exemptions, what are you talking about specifically? Home mortgage interest deduction, for example?
Well, no one's talking about elimination of the home mortgage deduction elimination. The Simpson-Bowles Commission said, let's just make it apply for the first home, and instead of having $1 million cap, have a $500,000 cap. It might be that you would get your first $100,000 of charitable contributions fully written off, but after that, you'd only get a 50% write-off. It would mean a whole series of issues around other tax preferences, and there are literally thousands of them in the tax code that we would, if not eliminate some, at least cut them back a little bit. You know, at the end of the day, I think most reasonable people agree we've got to cut spending. It's at an all-time high. Revenues are at a 60-year low. You can either do that by raising rates or you can do that by actually lowering rates but getting rid of tax expenditures. I think the way that is long-term cleaner and long-term probably more efficient is looking at lowering rates and then getting rid of some of these tax expenditures.
Let's talk about outside influence here because, as you know, when it comes time to picking which incentives and which deductions to eliminate, you're going to have a lot of pressure. You're going to have the real estate industry. You're going to have corporations. You're going to have farming industry and so on and so forth. So how do you pick which ones are legitimate and which ones aren't?
I think that's, in effect, what we're hired to do. And if we don't do a good job, we ought to all be fired. But I also think the only way in a practical sense you do it is if you put a package together that has a bit of shared sacrifice and everybody has skin in the game. If you do these sequentially, the forces of the status quo will always win. If we do something that says, no, let's try to share this pain around all the different sectors. Let's try to make sure that, again, it's balanced with spending cuts as well, so it's not just on the revenue side. At some point there is that appeal to patriotism over party that the American people, and candidly, I hope and pray at least, the American business will respond to as well. I think this issue is every bit as serious as the threat of fascism, the threat of communism, the threat of terrorism. It really is a question about what America and who America is going to be in the 21st century.
That's Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. He joined me from the Capitol building here in Washington. Senator Warner, thank you so much.
Guy, thank you.
Now, back in 1986, the government did reform the tax code. It was simplified. Eugene Sterley helped write it. He worked in the Treasury Department at the time. And he says ever since then, members of Congress have essentially undone most of that reform.
So every new elected official thinks that he has to or she has to tinker with the tax code as well. And so provisions get added onto provisions, and we get more and more complexity.
And so like barnacles on an old boat, the code grew and grew as members of Congress added their pet tax credits and loopholes to the code. So can it be simplified once again? That's a question I put to Republican Congressman Charles Bustani of Louisiana.
Clearly, we've seen an explosion in the number of deductions and credits. And I think what we need to do is have an honest look at all of these and develop some metrics on how you evaluate these credits, meaning who benefits, what is the economic impact, do these help create jobs, or do they have a very narrow application?
This coming week, the House and Senate Ways and Means Committees will hold a joint, historic joint meeting, for the first time, I guess, since 1940, to discuss tax reform. Let's say the ball starts rolling now, and all the members are serious about doing this. How long do you think it'll take to actually accomplish?
Well, it's difficult to say, but we know the 1986 tax reform process took a concerted effort for 3 years, and there was work done even prior to that. So we expect this to be a drawn-out process if we're going to get it right. You have to have many, many hearings to investigate all of these aspects of the tax code.
Congressman Bustani, as you know, in the minds of many Americans, we are living in an extremely hyper-partisan age. They look at Washington and they see that not a whole lot's getting done. And I wonder if there's an argument to be made that maybe this process should be taken out of the hands of Congress. In other words, similar to the plan to close down military bases in the 1990s, perhaps there should be an outside committee that simply reforms a tax code that is not necessarily beholden or influenced by outside interests.
I disagree with that, and I think clearly the Constitution spells out the authority for Congress with regard to the generation of revenues and taxation. In Congress, we are very serious about doing this. We've had a number of closed-door bipartisan sessions of the House Ways and Means Committee with the Joint Committee on Taxation to really look at details and technical aspects of the code. In fact, the very first week that the committee assembled, we had a closed-door meeting with all the members, both parties. And Chairman Camp, who
it's
chairs
Dave
the
Camp.
House Ways and Means Committee, Dave Camp from Michigan, he outlined his main goal was to undertake tax reform in a fundamental way, and he wants to do it in a bipartisan way as well.
That's Republican Congressman Charles Bustani of Louisiana. He's a member of the House Ways and Means Committee. He joined me here in our studio in Washington. Congressman, thank you.
Guy, it's really good to be with you.
David Stockman was Ronald Reagan's budget director back in the early 1980s, and he says the heart of the tax code problem can be illustrated through one simple example, the rate of taxes on capital gains.
I think the real issue in the top rate is that nobody pays it. In other words, that's the statutory rate. And you can have a great debate whether it should be 35 or 39%. I think we ought to let the Bush tax cuts expire. So the top rate would be 39%, but I don't think that's the real heart of the problem. The heart of the problem is that we have a preferential 15% capital gains rate. And that means that millionaires and billionaires are paying a lower rate on most of their income, which is capital gains and not earned, than the gardeners and the housekeepers who work for them. And that is totally wrong. It's unfair. And yet it's the heart of the tax system problem we have today. Now, why do we have 15% capital gains rate? Well, it's an obsolete provision that originated in the 1970s when we had double-digit inflation. And I supported it then. I was a member of Congress because with double-digit inflation, you were taxing in phantom gains, you know, on capital gains. A lot of the gain wasn't real. It was simply 10% inflation. But that's all gone. We don't have any serious inflation anymore. And so the whole rationale for a lower, dramatically lower capital gains rate has disappeared. And now it's just a huge windfall subsidy to the rich.
Essentially, most of the people who are earning capital gains and socking it away are wealthier, not necessarily wage earners. If you reform that and you taxed it at, say, 35%, how much do you think it could actually generate for the government?
It would all depend year to year on the rate at which capital gains would be realized, so it wouldn't be as predictable as income tax revenue, which other than marginal changes in employment, wouldn't change that much year to year. On the other hand, I will say that it would be multiple tens of billions of dollars because there is a huge amount of capital gains in the economy. And the more important point is that it would eliminate the incentive to game the system, to try to turn ordinary, earned income that every other American generates and has to pay tax on into capital gains. So I think if you ask the tax technicians, they might tell you that you would get 50 or 100 billion a year. But over time, after removing the incentives and putting the tax lawyers to work doing something more useful, I think it would generate even more revenue as income became more evenly and uniformly taxed.
That's David Stockman. He's the former budget director for President Ronald Reagan and a former Republican congressman. David Stockman, thank you.
Thank you.